And it's been a little while since I've taught, so I appreciate people who have taken over and kept the group going in my absence, Debbie and Anne. Yeah, I was just in touch with the group in Minneapolis, and there's a wonderful meditation center there called Common Ground that I've often taught at, and hoping to be able to visit them in September. And they were saying that their recovery group has really been struggling during the pandemic. So just a reminder how important it is for us to support each other in these continuing to be difficult times. So we'll begin with a period of meditation, and I will give some instruction. We'll sit for about 20 minutes, and then I'm going to talk. And we've been working with my book, A Burning Desire, and we are in the section on mindfulness, so that's convenient. So just settling back into a comfortable meditation posture, whatever supports your being alert and relaxed. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, stepping out of the visual world, turning the attention inward. And letting the body settle, relaxing the body, softening the belly, releasing the shoulders, loosening the jaw. These are some of the areas where tension appears. And just noticing any other parts of the body that are tense or tight, and seeing if you can soften. And feeling the breath moving in the body. Now, just engaging our awareness of the body with the breath as a focal point. Just this simple step in mindfulness helps us to be present, brings us into this moment, out of the thought world. So feeling the breath I'm starting to be more precise in feeling the sensations either at the nostrils, the chest or belly, and following the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath. And as you connect with the breath and the body, you can also tune in to the more subtle feeling realm or feeling world. Just noticing what's present for you, what you're feeling, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. This idea of a realm of feeling might be difficult to understand at first. It's a particularly Buddhist idea. Rather than talking about emotions and the particular emotions, rather, what is the quality of emotions and sensations as well? Is there a quality just of pleasant or unpleasant, or neither of those? We can think of these feelings as a kind of early warning system that let us know that there's some energy, some turbulence being stirred up in the mind and body or in the emotional world. So that early warning reminds us to stay open and connected to the present moment through the breath, but can act as a mindfulness bell. The more commonly understood distraction is the movements of thoughts. It's natural for our minds to wander into thinking as we try to stay present. You know, when we become aware that we are lost in thoughts, we acknowledge that and come back to the breath. As our awareness becomes more subtle and open, broad, we might start to see the nexus between thought and feeling, and then see how breath can engage in that nexus to hold those experiences in a spacious way, not to be lost. To feel the dynamic, moving quality, thoughts and feelings, sensations. Start to see all experience as a flow, a flux, body and mind. Nothing to hold on to, nothing static. The breath helps us to keep that perspective of watching the flow rather than being lost in it, swept away. I can't hear the bell, so. I had to look and see if people were reacting to it to know if it was coming through. All right. I don't have my hard copy of my book, Burning Desire, with me. So I went into my computer to see if I could find the, digital version of it. Because it's strange when a book gets published by a publisher, it goes through this all these different things that they do to it that you kind of, the thing that you wrote doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have it as a regular Word file. And interestingly, at least interesting to me, I found another draft of the book with a bunch of stuff in it that was not published and a lot of stories that I left out. So I'm kind of curious to go back and look at them, the story of my own childhood and my, life as a Catholic altar boy and all of that. So I'm going to have to dig through that and see if there's something worth putting out. In any case, as I mentioned, we're in the section called The Higher Power of Mindfulness. And so I'll read the little definition. I would call it definition of the higher power of mindfulness. It comes at the beginning of this section. The higher power of mindfulness is the power of attention and non-reactivity. It opens us to wisdom and insight through clear seeing. Mindfulness is the foundation of all spiritual growth as it reveals the truth of the way things are, internally and externally. So the first thing that strikes me, I'll read some sections here. There's one part where it really gets into defining mindfulness, what I want to spend some more time on, but I'll just read this one little piece here that I think is relevant. This is at least on my version of it. It's on page 38. I don't know if it's actually on that in the published version. I remember the feeling as I built up to a drunk. It was as if some force over which I had no control was pushing me. I was going to drink. There was no choice involved. I couldn't imagine an alternative. To not drink would be to die, would be to resist some fundamental natural law. That's the feeling that addiction gives you. That's the power of addiction. Mindfulness runs counter to that. The power of mindfulness is the power to see outside the blinkers, outside the tunnel, to see ourselves and our experience from a different perspective. We call this higher because it has a positive effect as opposed to the destructive lower power of addiction. Mindfulness actually shows the world to be simpler than our mind perceives it to be. Instead of the complex of problems, issues, doubts, hungers, and resentments that obsess and confuse an addict, mindfulness shows our experience to be simply that of six senses and those things that the senses can perceive. The Buddha calls the mind the sixth sense. The practices associated with mindfulness ask us to be aware of what is coming in through these six sense doors without judging those experiences or trying to figure them out, without trying to repeat or repel those experiences, without being overwhelmed or losing interest in them, simply allowing them to be. So this last sentence or two sentences, I think is a pretty good kind of definition of how we practice mindfulness. The practices associated with mindfulness ask us to be aware of what is coming in through these six sense doors. So that's the first thing. And that's, you know, obviously well understood. And sometimes people end their definition of mindfulness right there. Oh, it's just to be aware. And that does not capture the meaning of mindfulness as the Buddha expressed it. You know, there's some other sort of key elements to it. Because to just be aware could be a kind of passivity. And it doesn't imply any particular wisdom or even as, you know, the Buddha, you know, kind of is asking us to look in a particular way. So to go on with this, so be aware of what's coming in through this six sense doors. So what you're seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking, without judging those experiences or trying to figure them out. So this is like a very key thing, right, about mindfulness. That, and in a way, it's like, it's one of the first things we see is how much we do judge and try to figure out what we're experiencing. And so right away, we're forced to kind of like stop, go, oh, wait. Look what I'm doing about this thought or this feeling or this sensation, this perception. I'm doing something with it. I'm categorizing it, judging it, which means right away that I'm creating this kind of conflict with it. And obviously that's kind of duality, but there's nothing inherently bad about duality. I mean, it's like part of reality of our lives is dualism. But when it's creating an us and them or me and that and it, this problematic thing, then we are starting to really put kind of boundaries around our experience. This is good, this is bad, this is acceptable, this is unacceptable, which then leads to rejection or attachment, which is, you know, kind of the next thing that comes up. But the trying to figure it out, too, judging experiences, but then trying to figure it out, something I often quote James Barras, one of my most important teachers, someone who mentored me quite a bit, or tried. that this idea of how we try to figure things out, that where we overcomplicate life or try to get answers to things that we don't necessarily need to know. So that's his James will often say when somebody gets kind of like raising your hand, well, what about, you know, why did this person get cancer if they were such a good person? And sort of, and his response, you don't have to figure it out. And sort of saying that our job is to respond in this moment to our experience and respond skillfully. That's, you know, how we create positive karma. But we can't like figure out all the things that brought about this karma. And, you know, it's not that we should never think about things or try to figure them out. But when we see that we're getting caught in that as the answer, which is, so this can be like one of the limitations of psychotherapy. Well, I think there's tremendous value and sitting with someone and really working with our feelings and coming to understand some of our psychological history and all that. At a certain point, it can also just become this like, oh, if I can just find the answer, then then I'll be okay, or it's going to solve something. But we often find that, yeah, we do come to understand something, but the solution isn't in knowing why we're, you know, screwed up. No, it's what do I do in this moment to respond to my screwed upness? You know, what's the next step? That's where the solution lies, right? And that's why, of course, recovery is such a, in, you know, 12-step or whatever recovery program is so helpful, because they're so much focused on what do I do now in order to change things. I can't change the fact that I drank and used, or that I, you know, did this harm. What can I do now? So then the next line. So I'll keep repeating. It's the practice of mindfulness asking us to be aware of what's happening through the senses, and then not judging or trying to figure them out. And then without trying to repeat or repel those experiences. A nice little alliteration, if I do say so. But repeat or repel is a way of talking about craving and aversion, grasping and, you know, pushing away. And this is where the suffering comes from, right? This is classically out of the Buddhist teaching on the Four Noble Truths. The cause of suffering is craving. And that craving can also take a negative form, a craving to get rid of something. So we, you know, it's the idea of desire and aversion, or craving and aversion, is actually all contained just in craving. That, hopefully that makes sense. If it doesn't make sense to you intellectually, just meditate and watch your mind and you'll see that it's all about wanting, not wanting, wanting. Just so this is another key aspect of mindfulness. Again, it's not, okay, I'm aware of what's happening. I'm not judging it. And I'm seeing the tendency to grasp, to control. And so that the mindfulness allows me to interrupt that process. So this is where we really get down to what mindfulness is doing for us. It's allowing us to see how we create suffering and then make another choice in that moment to not repeat or repel these experiences, to not try to control or hold on to them, not try to get rid of them. The next line says, then without being overwhelmed or losing interest in them. So here's another aspect of our experience, right? So here we could say we're talking about equanimity and investigation, to the sort of deeper elements of mindfulness. So we're kind of drilling down into mindfulness, starting with the, okay, I'm aware through the senses. I'm not judging, trying to figure it out. So I'm just aware. I'm not letting my mind get in there and try to manipulate it all right away. And I'm not grasping or pushing away. So then, you know, trying to let go on that level, which is challenging because there's such a tendency. I was talking about feeling during the meditation today. There's such a tendency when there's a pleasant experience to try to hold on to it, when there's an unpleasant experience to try to push it away. So describing all this, you know, it's easy to describe it, relatively easy. But much more difficult to execute. It's not so simple as like, oh, okay, just don't hold on. Okay, I won't. Well, yeah, every moment there's the triggers for us to hold on. So it requires this vigilance. And so, but then in this experience, without being overwhelmed, part of the reason that we try to control our experience is to contain it and to keep it from overwhelming us. Alcohol and, you know, other drugs are somewhat used to contain things. It's like, oh, it's been a rough day. I'm like overwhelmed by my day. I'll have a drink and that'll suppress those feelings. That'll make me feel okay, so I won't be overwhelmed. So we take that away. And yeah, for I don't think it just for addicts, but certainly for addicts, it's like you take away that suppressive mechanism and it can be very intense. All the emotions that come up, the tendency to get stressed and fatigued, to get anxious, all the stuff that comes up. So mindfulness helps us to not be overwhelmed. And part of the way it helps us to not be overwhelmed is by the things that I described earlier, by especially the not clinging and not pushing away. So by allowing, and this is where kind of acceptance is the answer to my problems today, the famous line from the Big Book comes in. It's like, oh, okay, this is intense. Oh, if I don't engage in a struggle with it, then it's not so overwhelming. You know, it doesn't have to wipe me out. I can breathe and be with it. I can bring this intentionality, intentional calming, intentional breath, intentional presence. And that in itself diffuses a lot of the overwhelm. Now, that's not necessarily the end of the overwhelm, because, you know, again, we may have tendencies that, you know, are deeply embedded, past trauma, past psychological conditioning, that really get strong, and we can get flooded, activated. These great terms for those feelings of overwhelm. And so, I don't want to suggest that mindfulness is the answer to everything here. Sometimes other people are really a key. Maybe always other people are a key, you know, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the community, the fellowship. When there's overwhelm, sometimes just breathing with it isn't enough. We need to like call a friend or go to a meeting, or, you know, connect or go to the gym, you know, get exercise. You know, many ways that we can work with it, but mindfulness is the starting point, because mindfulness is the thing that shows us that we are coming into overwhelm, right? We have to see that it's happening, as if we're not aware of it, of course, we just get swept away before there's any consciousness of it. And we find ourselves yelling at people, or, you know, crawling under the covers, or opening a bottle of something. So without being overwhelmed, equanimity, and without losing interest in them. So this is another one of the subtle ways that we shut down, you know, getting passive. It's happening. Okay, fine. I'm just going to ignore it. And so staying engaged. Obviously, mindfulness is really about staying engaged. And the next sentence is simply allowing them to be. So, yeah. So, I'm going to go to the next paragraph too, because this is sort of, I think, balances or kind of carries this on. As mindfulness is cultivated by these practices, it grows in power. But the powers we cultivate aren't typical ones, like controlling others, gaining material possessions, or affecting events. So here I am in Washington, D.C., in the center of controlling others and gaining material possessions and affecting events. So the power of mindfulness is the power to be, the power to experience life fully without flinching, to feel our pain without running away, to feel our joy without clinging to it. The power of mindfulness is the power to see, as the Big Book puts it, to, quote, intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us, unquote. The power of mindfulness is the power to know beauty, to know love, directly, unfiltered. The power of mindfulness is the power of life. That kind of captures it, I think. But to go back here, so, you know, this is this idea, this book is, you know, premised on the idea that the Dharma is powerful. And so I'm kind of addressing that right away. And that sort of, first by sort of defining how we typically talk about powers, controlling others, gaining possessions, affecting events, you know, external power. The power to be, you know, to just allow things to be, you know, such a really remarkable power that we can develop through our practice. That, you know, because there's such a tendency to feel like we have to fix things or control things, fix people, you know, take care of people, or just change what we're feeling. And when we can just learn to feel and not be overwhelmed, not lose interest, not run away, that right away is a tremendous power. And it's one in a way that I, you know, the world doesn't sort of, you know, that's not something that's like talked about a lot in ordinary society. And yet, when you can exhibit it, it impresses people. You know, I think of the, in 2002, maybe it was 2003, there was an anti-war march in San Francisco. I have, this is in one of my books, it might be in this book. And it was, you may recall that one of our previous presidents decided that we needed to invade a small country in the Middle East for personal reasons, apparently. It's always been hard to really understand why. But I went to a protest, an anti-war protest, and it was in downtown San Francisco, but near the Ferry Building, and I got off BART and came up, and there's all these people in the streets, and then they had a big stage set up, and there were people just shouting into the microphones, you know, and it was every grievance that these people had against the United States, and it was kind of like, okay, yeah, that's true, yeah, oh yeah, we did that, oh yeah, that's yeah, and it was just like, ugh, but I went there because the Zen Center was going to have a group. And so, and I had my Zafu with me, I believe. And so I'm walking along, and there they are. There's 50 people, maybe, all just on the grass, just sitting. And I just sat down and meditated with them. And it was palpable, the energy of a large group of people just meditating in the midst of this chaos and anger. And it just felt so right, you know, it just felt so right. It was such a clear statement of anti-war, you know, anti-violence, if you want peace, you have to be peaceful, right? And we were sitting there showing what that looked like. And, you know, occasionally I would kind of glance and open my eyes a little bit and just see how people were kind of standing around looking at us like, wow, look at that, like these freaks, right? But also this, there was like, you could just tell that like people were very impressed by it, because it's like, it never occurred to me. Like I thought we should come down here and yell about how angry we were about this war. Oh, it never occurred to me that like, oh, we should come down here and express calm and peace. So that's just always really stood out in my experience as a moment that really exemplified what the power of the Dharma, the power of mindfulness practice, the power of loving kindness practice, the power of peace, just publicly exhibited, you know, it's nonviolence, right? And it's nonviolence, not just not being physically violent, but not being verbally violent, not being mentally violent. So the power of mindfulness is the power to be, the power to experience life fully without flinching. You know, how much do we run away? Do we flinch from pain, from suffering? I mean, we, you know, right, what's going on right now with these crazy laws that want to ban the teaching of American history? Don't let people know, don't let children know that there were horrible things that happened in this country. You know, no, we can't. That's just fear. I mean, it's a lot of things, but one of the things it is fear of feeling the pain of truth, you know. And, you know, it's tragic. American history is tragic. It's tragic and beautiful, you know, right? It's like amazing and wonderful and terrible. And that's life. And so that's to be the power to, what's this, the power to experience life fully without flinching. It's okay to feel our pain without running away. Obviously, this is an issue for addicts. You know, we're running away from pain, whether it's emotional pain or, you know, even physical pain that people get addicted to. That's the whole opioid crisis, starts with physical pain. And people, I mean, I don't blame people for wanting to get away from it, but, you know, we have to be more skillful, you know, to feel our joy without clinging to it. I mean, it's the same thing for addicts, you know. It's like one drink is good, two drinks is better, you know, just more, get more and more intoxicated, you know. We're having a really good time, let's make it better, you know. We have to intensify it all rather than just, oh, you know, this is pleasant. Can I enjoy the pleasantness, you know? And without clinging to it, like, oh, that was really fun yesterday. I need to do it again today, and I need to do it tomorrow, and I need to do the same thing, you know, get loaded every day. So that's a lot in just like two paragraphs of this book, apparently. Interesting. Anyway, I think I have talked enough for now, and I'd like to leave it open for people to join in if they would like to. Julie. Hi.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Sangha. It's wonderful to be here with you this morning. Just wanted to share a couple of things. A few months ago, Greg Pergament, one of his Sanghas, brought in the teaching of Andrew Oledsky. And the teaching was, and this is the first time I've heard mindfulness framed this way, but he has a teaching that says essentially, mindfulness arises from wholesomeness. And then just yesterday, this week on Saturday, in Pete's 12 Zen group, we're doing a book study on the 8 realizations of remarkable beings or something like that, by Brother Fab High. And what is the teaching there is mindfulness will always manifest in ethical behavior. So I had never, with all the study of mindfulness, I had never connected that mindfulness, in certainly in Buddhist context, I believe, it has to be arising from wholesomeness. It reflects ethicalness. So one cannot rob a bank mindfully. You can do it with concentration and focus and purpose and intention, but not with mindfulness, because it is not an ethical act. It is not arising from wholesomeness. And I just think that really blew me away, and that teaching about the connection. And I think we can, by your teaching today, Kevin, we can infer that as we go deeper and deeper. But I think it is overlooked a lot, especially as mindfulness becomes mainstream in the lexicon of, you know, secular lexicon. Mindfulness is really connected to wholesomeness and ethical behavior. It is just so much more than awareness and concentration and intention. So thank you for letting me share that. These wonderful teachings for me.
Great point, Julie. Thank you. Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I've always kind of insisted that my books be about Buddhism and the 12 steps, not mindfulness and the 12 steps, because it's true that the mindfulness, the secular mindfulness movement, can really underemphasize ethics and morality, and as you say, wholesomeness. And that's right. In Buddhist terms, mindfulness can't be harming. You can't be like very mindfully, you know, looking down the side of the gun. You know, that's a different mental quality, and it's more like concentration, which concentration can be devoid of a moral context, but mindfulness can't be. I'm pretty sure. I don't want to speak for, you know, the experts, but that's certainly my understanding of it. Thank you. It's always one of my themes, so I'd like to get to that. Hello, Amy O'Brien.
Hi. Hi, everybody. And thanks, Sangha and Kevin. I guess I wanted to add something that you said about psychotherapy. I'm a psychotherapist. But I think that it's very true that psychotherapy has the danger, has the danger of becoming about trying to figure it out or solve something, or but I guess I just want to say I don't think that's where it should end. And I think it does get stuck in that. But really, I think that there's a lot more congruence with mindfulness. They're actually so complementary, because part of what I think of psychotherapy as being about is actually, you know, that the insight piece or the figuring out can be really helpful to sort of understand oneself and how you got certain patterns and responses, and being compassionate to yourself, I think, too. It's like, oh, well, I learned this in relationship, but then that it can't end there. And it often, I think people do, but where it needs to go is to really be with the feelings. And in a kind of a similar way as mindfulness, but I think that the difference, well, it's actually also very congruent with what you're saying. It's the being with, and sometimes, especially with trauma, which we all have to a certain degree, there's a need to be with another person to feel certain feelings and to be able to really like experience them. So I think what you're saying in, you know, in this community with the Sangha, and we get that too. But I think sometimes when there's trauma, there's a need for more being with another person's mind and heart and them really listening. So anyway, I hope it didn't sound defensive, but I just wanted to kind of add that, because I think it can sometimes be like get a bad rap in that way, because there's a lot of of psychotherapy that can get stuck there, or both therapist and patient. I mean, there's a lot of us patients who just really have a tendency, especially addicts, to obsess, right? And it just gets stuck in that loop of trying to figure it out.
In the story,
But yeah, anyway, yeah.
Thank you. I don't hear it as defensive at all. I hear it as clarifying, and I, that's important. You know, I'm not a therapist, and I can easily fall into a like, well, my team is the Buddhist team, and like, you know, like the other teams aren't as good as my team. So absolutely. And I've had a lot of really helpful psychotherapy. I've had some where, just as you described, like I didn't know where it was going, and I didn't feel like the therapist helped me to understand it. But, you know, it's complicated, right? When we're trying to help somebody. But yeah, absolutely. And particularly, as you say, around trauma, and as I was talking about, like getting flooded and activated, where you really need someone there to help you to hold that.
Right. Right. Especially at certain points in the journey. Yeah.
Yeah. And somebody who's really a professional, who really understands it and has strategies, and isn't just like, oh, you'll be okay, or breathe. You know, it's like, that's not enough sometimes, you know. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And obviously the fact that so many therapists now are integrating mindfulness and things like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which I think is one of the most productive uses of therapy, you know, they're really sort of merging. And it's, I mean, Jack Kornfield kind of talks about this as like, you know, merging Western psychology and Eastern psychology is a really skillful way to respond to, you know, like contemporary Western minds and the suffering in our contemporary world that seems to have some elements that are, you know, more a little tougher to uproot than some of the things the Buddha might have talked about, you know. In other words, we're sicker than ancient Buddhists. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, and mindfulness is a great practice, obviously, of like how to learn to stay with emotions, especially, and not get overwhelmed. So anyway, yeah, they're great together, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you for speaking up. And please, I certainly hope everyone feels safe enough to speak up if I say something that feels a little off or incomplete or needs some, you know, additional. That's great. I'm just reading reading Monica's little post. That's nice. And I don't know what page we were on in A Burning Desire. Oh, Susan said it was page 30. So thank you. That's good. I guess you guys know that we've got a retreat coming up in May. There still is room, and there is scholarship money for those who need support. I think the link is in here for that. It's also on the front page of my website if you're interested. I am also going to be at Southern Dharma with Greg Bergamont leading up to the week before Labor Day, ending on Labor Day. And that's near Asheville, North Carolina. That's going to be open for registration on May 1st, and it fills up very quickly. So if you're on the East Coast and want to come to a retreat, check that out. It looks like I'm going to be in Wisconsin and Minneapolis in the end of September. So that's my entire schedule other than Zoom. Oh, I'm doing a day long for Spirit Rock with Vimala Sara. It's actually the Sunday after this retreat ends. So that's going to be the 22nd of May. That'll be fun. Always love teaching with her. So I will be back on Friday night with you when I should be broadcasting from the Vincenti Avenue studios of Kevin Griffin Incorporated. And you know, I hope to see you all then. And be well.